This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Chicago, 2011. A cop is murdered. Police and prosecutors swear they have the trigger man. He swears he didn't do it. How far will each side go to prove they're right?
Like it's just one bombshell after another, you know, where you're like, what?
The story of a PlayStation, a brain-eating amoeba, and the relentless pursuit of justice. Off Duty, out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to the very end of the episode to get a rundown of the latest news. But first, compared to the past, it's safe to say that more and more people are finding themselves represented in census numbers these days, and the latest figures might prove that. New census data show the number of same-sex couple households in the U.S. has nearly doubled over the past two decades, between 2005 and 2024. But here in Chicago, the story is a little more nuanced. What does that growth actually look like here, and what's behind the change? From the evolution of census survey methods to the legalization of same-sex marriage, in this next conversation, we're digging into how LGBTQ households are showing up in the data, what progress has been made, and where gaps still remain. At the table was Allison Bethel, who's director of the Fair Housing Legal Clinic at the University of Illinois Chicago Law School. Christine Prochesky, who's a sociology professor and faculty fellow at the Institute of Policy Research at Northwestern. And Moni Ruiz Velasco, who's a commissioner of the Illinois Human Rights Commission. We started by hearing from each guest what their initial thoughts were when they heard the new data about same-sex couple households. Were they surprised about the growth? Christine wasn't. She went first.
We've seen this steady increase over time and a big increase since the Obergefell ruling in 2015, which spread access to marriage across the country to all same-sex couples. And so over time, we've seen that more couples are able to more publicly live together or declare their unions. Mm-hmm. And so it's great to see that people are willing to be identified in the data now. And so this is not surprising, but it's good news for all of us who want people to be able to live as they want and
sure.
be identified.
Yeah, on its head, it definitely feels like a positive, right?
Yes.
Allison, what comes to mind when you hear this news?
Yeah, well, I too am glad that people are able to live how they want and where they choose. HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which enforces fair housing laws, did a study back in 2013 that showed there was rampant discrimination, mm-hmm. access to housing issues for LGBT folks. So mm-hmm. then coming forward to where we are now, I'm glad to see that there has been some progress in that regard, with more households coming forward, identifying and feeling comfortable in their housing choices.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about some of those protections for folks in a moment, Allison. But Moni, let me get your reaction to the news.
Yeah, I think, again, I'm not surprised either. As more and more folks identify as LGBTQ, as there has been an increase in visibility for our communities overall, as a young person, I didn't necessarily grow up seeing LGBTQ married couples. And I think sometimes it's hard to imagine what is possible when you can't see it in front of you. So as visibility is critical for growth, for stability for the community and for safety. And I think that as more and more of us are visible and are public about our lives, it is critical for the younger generations coming behind us, and
right.
more and more of them are identifying as LGBTQ.
That's true. It's much more present in their reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's talk more specifics and zoom in a little bit. So in 2024, the census recorded 1.4 million same-sex couple households. That's where we get the fact that it nearly doubled since 2005.
Yes.
We crunched some of the local data. So there were a couple of interesting tidbits here that I want to share. So there are more same-sex couples in Chicago than in the suburbs and the rest of the state. You're all nodding, right? Sounds about right. Same-sex couples make up 1.7% of couples here in the city and about 0.75% in the rest of Illinois. We have so-called community areas in Chicago, and the two with the highest percentage of same-sex couples are Uptown, Edgewater, and Rogers Park, and Lakeview and Lincoln Park. So I'm looking at you, Christine. Do we know if there are more queer couples now than there used to be, or if, like you kind of alluded to already, are more people just telling their business? They're telling census who they're partnered with.
Yeah. So it's hard to know historically because people didn't have the option to identify on many of these forms.
Right.
And the way we've asked these questions has changed. But all indications are that more couples are able to live together publicly and certainly have access to marriage. And so all indications are this is a real change, at least on the number of couples who are able to live together and to be publicly married and legally married.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So we've seen real change over time. You know, the estimates are that in the year 2000 in the U.S., there were about 670,000 same-sex couples, and we're up to 1.4 million now.
Okay.
And then estimates further back get really dicey, maybe about half that level, around 300,000 in the year 1990, but hard to know because we just didn't ask the questions in the same way, and people didn't feel comfortable telling the government if they were in same-sex relationships.
Your thoughts on that, Moni, just that pattern of growth and what Christine brings up here. People weren't comfortable saying what was going on in their household.
Yeah, and I want to say it's not just that they weren't comfortable, but they were criminalized for it. Illinois didn't decriminalize same-sex relationships until 1961, and they were the first state to do it. So, you know, it's not just that people weren't comfortable, it's just that people weren't safe to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But queer people have existed for all eternity, as long as there have been people around, and will continue to exist in the long term. And I want to say, too, there's about 28% of us here in Illinois who are raising kids as well as same-sex couples. So, you know, I think there's more visibility again to what our families look like and just more visibility overall for LGBTQ families and LGBTQ couples.
Does that visibility feel more accepted right now in 2026?
Well, I think that the answer is yes, even though there are obviously massive efforts underway to erase LGBTQ rights, erase LGBTQ identities. But notwithstanding the efforts of the federal government to roll back protections and roll back visibility, the reality is the vast majority of the public support LGBTQ equality.
Yeah. And Christine brought up the June 2015 Supreme Court case, right, which legalized same-sex marriage earlier. I'm curious to hear from you, Moni, whether you thought that there was an immediate impact there. Did we see a change right away, or did it take some time?
I think there was an absolute immediate impact. And I can tell you a personal story from at that time, I was doing immigration law. I was an immigration lawyer. And that same day that decision came out, I had several people reach out to me and say, we can now be legally married in the U.S. And we'd like to, you know, take that step and, you know, get married and be able to immigrate their partner, somebody who had a partner who wanted to immigrate their partner. So I think there was an immediate impact there. I also want to say Illinois, because, you know, want to kind of center it back on Illinois, was the last state to pass a marriage equality law in 2013.
That's right.
So that no matter what happens at the federal level, although the marriage protection laws are pretty protected at the federal level, Illinois' laws are solid, and people here have, you know, more protection and more rights.
Before we dig in with Allison on some of the housing practices that we've seen over the years, Christine, I want to go back to the question piece that you brought up, right? Because that's interesting, and I don't think that everybody knows that. In 2007, the Census Bureau added a direct cohabitation question and a second parent identification question. Tell us a bit more about that and what that change allowed.
that change allows us to be able to see who's parents to whom in a household and for people to identify themselves as being the same-sex partner or the different sex partner of someone in a household. And especially in the states that did not have access to marriage, that helped us better identify these households. There was also a very important in-the-weeds sort of change in 2019 to how the government asked questions on many of our surveys, which improved our count. So more categories for relationships to the household head and more validation steps saying, okay, you said your partner, you know, is a man and that you're married to them. Can you verify that? And that was important to getting the number of couples right also because if different sex couples... They're such a much larger share of the population. And if some of those people made a mistake in filling out the form on what their partner's gender was, we were also getting misestimates. So together, we're getting better estimates and more data on, you know, who these families and couples are. And that's important for understanding economic issues and poverty issues, for understanding parenting, all of these things.
So Allison, I'll turn to you now. Set us up. Are there protections under the Fair Housing Act for LGBTQ couples?
Yeah, so this has really been a difficult issue in more recent times. LGBT sexual orientation and these sorts of classes are not protected on the federal level. They have never been directly protected under the federal level. Sex is protected, and that has been protected, since about the mid-70s. And while there were efforts to add sexual orientation, gender identity, et cetera, to the federal law, it just never got passed. But as my colleagues here have talked about, as we've become more humane, yes, in our understanding of people, sexuality, and rights, we certainly believe that housing is a human right entitled to, everyone is entitled to. We have seen some shifts in the law. So what happened was in 2019, the Biden administration issued rules that basically indicated that HUD, which is the agency charged with enforcing the fair housing laws, should protect LGBTQIA couples under the sex protections of the Federal Fair Housing Act. However, more recently, the Trump administration has withdrawn
They're rolling back a lot of protections.
A lot.
And so, particularly for the LGBTQ community.
And that has really set up, quite frankly, a conflict in the federal system. Number one, we have the HUD laws that have been, or rules that have been withdrawn. But on the other side, we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision that was adjudicated, the Bostock decision, which was a Title VII housing, employment discrimination case. But it recognized that under the sex protections, gender identity and LGBTQ folks should be protected. So you've got the Supreme Court saying sex is broad enough to encompass those factors. You've got HUD rules saying, no, they're not, and they will not be enforced. So it is really a conundrum on the federal level.
And I'm going to add another layer. We still have explicit housing protections in Chicago and Illinois for the gay community. But is that enough, especially considering what you just laid out when it comes to federal protections?
It's not enough, in my opinion. Certainly, as you look around here in Chicago and actually throughout the country, we still see rampant segregation. Even in your opening remarks, you were able to identify communities,
right,
where people live instead of, you know, being the integrated communities envisioned by the Fair Housing Act. But I am delighted and I am thrilled, and I think it is good news for your listeners to know that they live in Illinois, where we have some strong protections. If you're in Chicago, that's great too. We have protections here and even more broadly through Cook County, despite the dismal news on the federal level.
Yeah. What else can you share, Moni, on what statewide protections look like for in real life for LGBTQ couples and families?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as was mentioned, Illinois has some of the strongest laws to protect LGBTQ people generally in LGBTQ families, as it relates to housing, as it relates to education, as it relates to access to identity documents. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been advocates organizing for years and years and years to fight for these protections, and we are in one of the states, one of the top five states that
right.
have the strongest protections for LGBTQ.
And how can
folks.
We make sure those laws are equally applied across the state?
Yeah, I think that's
not in these pockets.
Exactly. I think that's definitely always the hard part, right? As we have laws that are statewide, and we don't necessarily see implementation equally across the state. And I think the best thing, you know, in those situations is, again, you know, again, back to the visibility piece, right, mm-hmm. is for people to report when they can, when they see discrimination across the state. There are agencies in place like the Illinois Department of Human Rights, like the Illinois Human Rights Commission, where I work, where, you know, our role is to ensure that the laws are applied across the state.
Right.
And yeah, and I think it is always, you know, unfortunately, there's no magic wand that would allow everything to be equal all the way across, no matter what the laws are.
Right.
And so we all need to work together to keep each other safe and protect each other as these things come up.
Christine, I want to throw in one more interesting finding. There are more female same-sex couple households in the U.S. than male ones. But when we crunch those local numbers, we found that there are actually more male same-sex households in Chicago proper, but more female in the suburbs and the yeah. rest of Illinois. I mean, I know you're just getting your yeah. mind wrapped around that right now, but I'm curious what you make of a trend like that and whether you just anticipate we see this increase continue.
Yeah. Well, I would point to the role of children being part of the story. Mm. So more female households, more women-led households have children than male-male couple households. And so this may be part of the story. This may be part of the story in Chicago. I will say that more broadly, we've seen, you know, if we go way back to 2008, at that point in time, nationally, we saw more men couples than women couples having their own households in the data. So it's a really interesting change over time that we've seen the rise of women couples in these data. And I think it points to a few things, including that more women are able to form households without worrying about custody for their children or their children's safety. And also points to women's resources changing
right.
over this period, too.
So as we wrap here, I want you in 10 words or less to tell me what protections you still want to see in place locally or nationally just to fully support the LGBTQ community. You first, Allison.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for raising awareness of this issue, particularly in April, which is Fair Housing Month. And in terms of stronger protections, I mean,
yeah.
I definitely would like to see more coverage on the federal level, stronger protections on the federal level.
Right.
And then we can have the law, but there's that enforcement piece that is critical. So
that's right.
We need more resources with enforcement. And then just finally, as Moni mentioned, we need people to speak up, speak out. Okay, housing discrimination has often been unreported. People on various levels, people feel reluctant to come forward with it. But if we don't raise our voices, we see what is happening to
right.
our civil rights and our human rights.
Christine?
I'd like to speak up for data issues, and especially when we see the federal government changing how they collect some of these data and erasing, making it hard for the public to access this data. This is crucial to protecting rights and understanding populations. And so understanding same-sex couples
yeah.
and the well-being of their children, we have to protect data integrity.
And quickly, Moni?
Quickly, there is no segment of the LGBT community that has been more impacted than the trans community by the federal administration, and we need to mandate access to healthcare that is affirming and that is the necessary healthcare for all people, and demand that people have access to that at every level, at the local, state, and federal level.
Moni Ruiz Velasco is commissioner of the Illinois Human Rights Commission. Christine Prochesky is an associate professor of sociology, and Allison Bethel is director of the Fair Housing Legal Clinic at UIC. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
Chicago, 2011. A cop is murdered. Police and prosecutors swear they have the trigger man. He swears he didn't do it. How far will each side go to prove they're right?
Like it's just one bombshell after another, you know, where you're like, what?
The story of a PlayStation, a brain-eating amoeba, and the relentless pursuit of justice. Off Duty, out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's turn now to the top news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ senior editor Alexandra Solomon, and Chicago Sun-Times politics reporter Mitchell Armentrout. The cherry blossoms are out. We're starting to see the pretty seasonal flowers all around the city. Here's Claire with more.
There were some sightings over the weekend, and now they are sort of in full blossom swing. Mm. As you know, these trees are kind of weather dependent. Some seasons are shorter than others if it's too dry, but apparently the wetness is good. And after 2 years of disappointing blooms on the south side of Jackson Park, this was in 2023 and 2024,
right?
We're off to a very bright start in terms of the coloring, very bright pinks and whites at Jackson Park. So it's a sight to see.
I'm so glad they're here. I got so sick of my friends in D.C., bragging about their cherry blossoms already.
We have our own zen.
We have our own zen. How long do folks get to see them here in Chicago?
So there are 200 cherry trees at Jackson Park. There's also some at the Botanic Gardens. I believe there's some at the Morton Arboretum in Lyle as well.
Oh,
but
cool.
Typically, the Chicago Bark District is saying for the Jackson Park bloom, next 5 to 10 days is when you really want to get down there and check these out.
Oh, the clock is ticking, Mitch and Alexandra.
I know. We can all use a little joy from the cherry blossoms.
Rebirth, honey.
That's right.
not your cup of tea, Mitch?
Oh, it's absolutely my cup of tea. And I will say, you want to have yourself a nice Chicago morning. Jackson Park, cherry blossoms.
Yes.
This is peak bird migration season. Mm. You'll have a great time.
Oh, love that. Part of the reason that we're having such a good cherry blossom is due to all the rain. As Claire pointed out, the wetness is good. We're going to see more later in the week, but flooding, when we talk about rain, it's always a risk, Alexandra, and your team's taking a closer look at the flooding problem. You got a story coming out Friday. What else can you share?
Yeah, right. The rain's great for the cherry blossoms, not so great for people's homes, for our sewers, for the streets. You know, anybody who's been out and about the last week or so is aware that flooding is an issue.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, with climate change, we're not going to be getting less rain. We're going to be getting more rain. And so the problem is one that, you know, policymakers and urban planners have a lot of ideas about how to address. We're going to be looking at some of those solutions. Some are small, some are larger scale. And also taking a look at, you know, not every community is impacted equally by flooding, depending on investment and the like. So we're going to be looking at how different communities have been impacted.
Yeah, that's I'm glad you brought that up, because it does sound every time we talk about these flooding stories, like, you know, certain parts of the city have these flooding problems every time it rains, while others kind of get to evade it a little bit.
Right. And it's complicated, you know, why that's the case. And it depends area by area. In some cases, it's, you know, combination of geology and infrastructure and other factors. And we're going to take a look at why that's the case and what's being done to address it or not in some cases.
In other news, it's day one of the civil rights trial over the Chicago police shooting that killed 13-year-old Adam Toledo in 2021. That wrapped up yesterday. Now, I want to play, first of all, Mitch, before I get you to sort of fill us in on how day one went. Here's Toledo's family's lawyer, Adina Weiss-Ortiz.
We look forward to presenting the facts and evidence to a jury and having a jury decide whether this shooting was justified.
So what happened on day one, Mitch?
So this is, it's hard to believe it's actually been 5 years since this happened. happened in Little Village. The city's now defunct ShotSpotter gun detection alert system mm-hmm. went off in a neighborhood. Chicago police officer Eric Stillman started a brief foot chase with Toledo. And the body cam footage from this incident shows Toledo dropping or throwing a gun to his side, not pointing it at Stillman, but Stillman shot him in the chest. Toledo was killed at the scene. So this really kind of has all the hallmarks of so many of the tragic and controversial police shootings that Chicago has played host to over the years.
And it was, you know, just memory serving me, one of the first times that the footage, the body cam footage, really went viral. I mean, people were in real time here in Chicago.
It was so graphic.
Watching this, it was graphic, responding in real time. And it really did cause, you know, kind of a lot of people to become very emotional about this.
Right. And, you know, emotional on both sides of this issue, because this all happens, this whole encounter happens basically in the span of 1 second. So you've got folks kind of more on the police advocate side who say that this is a justified use of force. The Civilian Office of Police Accountability did not agree with that. That's the city's independent police investigation agency that mm-hmm. investigates use of force. They said that Stillman should have been fired for this. And in this lawsuit, Toledo's family is basically saying that Stillman was diagnosed by the Department of Veteran Affairs with stress, basically just kind of a stressful stress from his military career that should have precluded him from being hired as a police officer. So we'll see how far that goes with the jury.
Alexandra, back over to you, because electric bills are high for a lot of residents. I know you don't have the answers to that problem, but
turn your lights off.
Yeah.
Live in the dark.
That's right.
Well, as some homeowners are opting to install solar panels on their roofs, that's not an option for the renters. But it could change.
Yes. So there's a bill making its way through the state, and this would allow people to put small solar panel systems. So this is like a solar panel that would fit on your balcony that you can plug into a wall socket. So, for example, you could power your refrigerator with a solar panel, which, you know, helps reduce your electric bill. Mm-hmm. And the bill will make it basically easier for people who rent to do this. You know, they won't have to get an interconnection agreement before doing it. They can, you know, right now, if you'd be required to get the electricity provider's approval before installing solar panels, that would be waived. It would make it easier for people to put in these small solar panel systems.
Cool. All right, let's talk basketball, folks. Michigan beat Connecticut last night and won their second NCAA title. But that's not the only basketball news. So first of all, let's give a shout out to Michigan.
And
right?
Go Blue, yes.
Who predicted this? Did anyone predict that they were going to win?
I had UConn at the end of my bracket, so I'm not terribly thrilled about this situation.
I always put the Illinois teams at the top, so my bracket got busted when the Illini lost.
Oh, geez. You sound a little bitter there, Claire.
Oh, good. There's always next year.
Well, you might still be bitter with this next story, because Chicago Sky fans, I know many of them, I saw the outrage all over the internet yesterday. They're shocked, and they're upset, because Angel Reese was traded. She's going to the Atlanta Dream, Claire.
Yes, people love her. I mean, she's a star, and she's a star in other regards too. We know she's been modeling.
Oh,
she's got a lot of charisma, very, you know, physical player. She brings a lot of attention under the net. But in return, the team is getting a couple of first-round picks. Time to rebuild for the Sky. But, you know, our sports contributor, Sherway Stout, kind of said the writing was on the wall about this. Pretty out in the open that Reese and the Sky maybe weren't seeing eye to eye toward the end of last
having
season.
Having some issues with the front office there.
Having some issues with the front office. Reese was suspended toward the end of last season by the Sky for criticizing the front office for not bringing in what she called enough quality players. Mm-hmm. So then when she returned from that half-game suspension, she actually didn't play much again. She was nursing a back injury.
Yeah, the one game I went to, I was so frustrated. She wasn't there. I was like, oh, man, I wanted to see you.
Yeah, so not enough quality players, and I'm saying this in quotes, and now she's being traded essentially for two potential draft picks, which is kind of interesting.
So, Mitch, I got to bring you in on this because, okay, the Sky are now going to have first-round picks for the next three seasons, essentially. Great advantage, but did it make sense to lose your all-star player?
It's really unfortunate that they had to do that, and I think a lot of fans would say they didn't have to do it. Because, those draft picks, you know, those are certainly valuable, but Atlanta's a really good team. Those are going to be lower draft picks. Those are going to be towards the bottom of the first round. And Angel is, you know, she's the face of the franchise. She's one of the faces of the WNBA. And it's just kind of, this is the latest time that this has happened with this guy. You know, Kalea Copper a few years ago, she was another player who was face of the franchise, a budding superstar. And she was jettisoned. And, you know, this guy is just kind of in this perpetual sort of rebuilding mode, it feels like, which is very familiar to Chicago fans of other teams as well.
We love a rebuild in this city.
Well, I mean, they also had their collective bargaining agreement, right? Their new bargaining agreement was going to give Angel Reese more money, right? Going from like $75,000 a year, which was, I mean, come on, for playing in the WNBA, to $350,000. So now the Sky don't have to pay that out. Necessarily.
Right. And that's certainly no small consideration in this whole deal. Because, Angel's salary could go up over $1 million, depending on how she does.
What I'm saying is money is always at the root of these decisions.
Very much so. Yeah.
You know, change must be in the air for basketball, Claire, because the Chicago Bulls also fired some top brass.
Yes, the Bulls, as we know, are having a losing season. They are 29-49 so far, the team has decided to let go of its executive vice president. That's Arturis Karnišovas and GM Eric Eversley, or rather Mark Eversley. They've been with the Bulls for the past six seasons, but in that course of time, they've only made it to the playoffs once. So rebuilding?
Yes, that is the word of the day.
And if you're looking to watch some bad basketball, the Bulls are actually taking on the Wizards tonight on the road. Geez. The Wizards are 17-61.
Oh, don't threaten us with a good time, Claire.
So if you just have hoops on the mind, you need more. Tune in.
What other stories are you following?
Well, I just thought this was interesting. Farmers market season approaching, and a lot of people tend sometimes to shop at farmers markets because the produce tends to be cheaper. But some farmers market vendors are saying that they're feeling the effects of inflation, just like we are. Green City Market kicked off in Lincoln Park over the weekend. Sometimes was there interviewing folks. Gasoline is a big problem. A lot of these farmers are coming in from Michigan, Indiana, and they're saying that it's costing maybe $2 to $3 more per gallon to fill up their tank. So we'll see if that has an impact on farmers market season here in Chicago.
How about you, Alexander? What other stories are on your radar this week?
Yeah, my team's got a story. Adriana Cardona Magigad and Esther Jean King have a story coming out tomorrow looking at how migrants are faced with a sort of new housing crisis. People might remember we had a lot of people sleeping in police departments, you know, on the floor of police stations, and then people were in shelters, and then there were programs with vouchers to help them find housing, but there's been change in federal immigration policies that have affected their status and ability to work, and, you know, there's already like an affordable housing crisis in the city, and this has hit the migrant community particularly hard and made them vulnerable to some predatory practices, so we're going to be looking at that.
Oh, I can't wait for that. Mitch. The White Sox.
The White Sox couldn't have started the season much worse.
But that's what's on your brain because you're covering them.
I am, yeah. And they couldn't have had a much better weekend against your beloved Blue Jays.
We're not going to go down that lane again, Mitch.
But the Sox are looking, you know, they're playing some decent baseball, better than it looked at first, at least. So, you know, they play this afternoon against the Orioles, looking for a big start from Shane Smith. He's trying to get his footing. The White Sox all-star starter from last year. You know, it could be
worse.
They're
looking good. I was at the game Sunday. I have to admit, the team's looking better. So
there you go.
I'm optimistic.
There you go.
We'll leave it there. Chicago Sun-Times, Mitch Armantrout, and WBEZ's Alexandra Solomon and Claire Lane. Thanks for listening to In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. Join me here every weekday for in-depth coverage of Chicago news and culture. Let's talk again soon.